Okay. I'd like to thank the organizers. I really like these workshops in Santa Barbara, and this one is very good. So I will talk indeed about some aspects of universal dynamics in thermally isolated systems. So let me first acknowledge my collaborators in various parts of works I'll be presenting. These are some students, Guy Bunin, who is working with Yariv Kafri in Technion, Luca D'Alessio, and Claudia De Grandi, who is here, both in BU. And Christian Gogolin did some important piece in what I'll be telling. And also my longer-term collaborators, Vladimir Gritsov, Yariv Kafri, and Ludwig Messi. So first, let me just give a sort of my own internal motivation, why I'm interested in these questions. So it's actually about universality, because we know that in equilibrium, at least largely, we are interested in solving models, understanding various phenomena, because they're universal. So it means that there are lots of details in the models which are not really important. And so basically, my motivation is to which extent what we can extend out of this to non-equilibrium situation. For example, is there like notion of universality in quantum dynamics? So if yes, in what sense? Can we classify perturbations according to their relevance, irrelevance? Is it different from equilibrium? So how is complexity of dynamics is related to universality? So we know that in equilibrium, we don't care much whether systems are integrable or non-integrable, for example. But for dynamics, we believe it's important. How do we describe relaxation in integral, non-integrable, in weaker integrable systems? Can we think about this as RG process? If yet, yes, what it is? And how we reconcile quantum classical complexity, and more generally, statistical physics, quantum dynamics, and classical dynamics. So I'm, of course, not going to answer all of these questions, but this is sort of what is my own motivation. So this is a list of topics I will be presenting. So I know some of you heard some parts of these talks, but there will be hopefully some new things as well. So first I will talk a little bit about nearly adiabatic dynamics near quantum critical points, and we'll talk about how various universal scalings arise from fidelity and concepts like that. So this is if you want pre-built universality. So universality, which is there in equilibrium, is manifests itself in away from equilibrium. Then I talk, when I'm talking about non-adiabatic effects, I'll be talking about various measures, fidelity, energy, and so on. But we know in thermodynamics that the measure of non-adiabaticity is entropy. And so I'll introduce diagonal entropy, and there are some new results which I didn't talk about. So basically, I will just say that, I'll argue, you can remove what a diagonal, and there is entropy, which plays the role of thermodynamic entropy, which is just related to energy distribution. And there is no contradiction, as far as I can say, between any of the laws of microscopic dynamics and thermodynamics. So then I'll more like flash about more recent work, which is still largely in progress, that indeed we can think about relaxational dynamics in an isolated system without a basis and RG process, and I will explain what I mean by them. And in particular, I will argue that you can derive universal dynamics near non-equilibrium Coase-Westauli phase transition in real time. And finally, this is a very recent work, which I'll also more like advertise than say, is that we can get universal energy distributions in externally driven systems. So basically, I'm going to say, what's the difference between chicken which we heat in usual oven and chicken which we heat in microwave? So in usual oven, we can use Gibbs distribution, fluctuation, dissipation theorem, and so on. Can we do it in a microwave? And I will argue that there is a very simple and very universal, unique answer. All right, so I welcome questions at any moment. So there is a There are very few facts about quantum phase transitions which I need for this talk. So they're characterized by divergent correlation lengths with some exponent nu. They're characterized by vanishing gap or some energy scale. It's not necessarily that both systems are gapped or one is gapped. For shortness, I will call it gap. It's some crossover energy scale, which also vanishes, well, which vanishes also in a universal way. And typically, there are some singular, sometimes divergent susceptibilities. And we know that equilibrium properties of the systems are universal near critical point, both classical and quantum. So what can we say about non-equilibrium dynamics? And this is like a specific protocol which I keep in mind. So we'll start with simplicity at a quantum critical point. We can end in quantum critical point. We can actually cross the quantum critical point. This is like a specific protocol which will help me to put like lots of results in the same framework. So there will be some tuning parameter and some relevant or marginal operator. It doesn't have to be relevant or marginal, but then you have less universality. And obviously, if you don't apply relevant perturbation, it's hard to leave this critical point. So we will...
The same lambda as the one at the bottom here?
Yeah.
Then V must be...
V must be relevant or marginal. Exactly. Yes, yes. It must be relevant, but it can be marginal as well, actually.
Okay.
For what I'm...
Marginally relevant.
Okay. Yes. So it's important for me, the only fact which is important to me, that this object has a scaling dimension of energy. If not, then lambda and V have separate scaling dimensions, and then I have to amend what I'm saying. So basically, we turn on this lambda according to some protocol, which I'm going to specify in future, and then we will ask what happens with the system, so generally with excitations of the system. So like simplest protocol we can imagine is sudden quench. So we suddenly change lambda from the critical point to some finite value. And then we can ask which states we are exciting. Well, and then we can just argue that, well, there is a characteristic energy scale gap. And the states with energy which are far above this gap, they're probably not much affected by the quench. So they don't care. But states which are well below this gap, they're strongly affected. So they will be populated. So actually, from this, I can say that roughly, if the states I can characterize by single particle excitations, their density will be one of the correlation lengths power d, and we get like first universal scaling. It's this quench amplitude power d nu. So same we can say about excess energy or the heat. So it's energy about nu instantaneous ground state. It will be roughly a number of these excited states times the characteristic energy which each state has. And this will be this another universal result. Well, now we can ask, so what instead of sudden quench we do with, say, linear quench? So instead of suddenly changing parameter, we're just changing it with, according to some protocol. So we know that near critical point system cannot be adiabatic. Just because there is no gap, there are lots of singularities. But if we are very far, then probably adiabaticity is restored as long as velocity is small. So we can use the same logic. We need to find some characteristic energy scale beyond adiabaticity, beyond which adiabaticity is restored. And we will say that states below this energy scale will be occupied. States above this energy scale will be not. So how we find it? Well, we can use a simple Landau-Zinner criterion. So we just say that characteristic rate of change of some energy scale, say gap, should be equal to gap squared. It's just dimensional analysis. Then we know the gap changes as tuning parameter power z nu. Tuning parameter is linear in time. We just solve the system of equations. We find characteristic time where beyond which adiabaticity is restored characteristic length scale. Then we do the same thing as before. And we find another universal prediction. Then number of excitations is this single particle states, if you want, this velocity, and some other combination of universal exponents.
How does this scaling change if you're in a classical transition?
Next slide. So classical Keeble-Zurich mechanism. So what if, and this was, of course, work which much preceded this one. So what if we're just changing classical phase transition? So this is like a Kibble-Zurich scenario. So we are changing either tuning parameter or temperature, say with some velocity across the critical point. And we know that relaxation time diverges near the quantum critical point. So it's not possible to follow the equilibrium. It's not a ground state, but now equilibrium state. So it's not possible to be quasi-static. And then they said, okay, so let's find a point where distance to reach this critical point is the same as relaxation time. And at this time, the system freezes. So let's just use this criteria. So time to reach critical point is just t minus tc over v. Relaxation time is 1 over tc minus t power z nu. We just do a little algebra. We find that this distance to the critical point is some universal power of velocity. Then we use the same sort of argument to find number of excitations from correlation lengths, and we are getting exactly the same answer. So it's exactly the same. So it's Kibble-Zurich scaling. Good. Now let's make even more general protocol. So let's assume that we start at arbitrary power. Now we know what to do. We solve our Landau linear problem. We separate our dynamics into diabatic and adiabatic. Sometimes people call it impulse and adiabatic. Doesn't matter. And we find this another universal answer. So let me try to summarize what we found with this family of protocols. So it's some power law of protocols. V is a small parameter. Then we have a power R, so it's basically R is the smoothness of the protocol near the critical point. And then we found that in both cases, density of excitation, so energy, excess energy heat, described by one universal formula. So it's one family. So the sudden quenches, so the slow quenches, they're described by one family of, they're one family of protocols. So then we need to understand, what is V? Actually, in all cases, V is a adiabatic parameter. It controls proximity to the instantaneous of the ground state. So if we have a sudden quench, but of small amplitude, we are still adiabatic because we are close to instantaneous ground state. If you're doing slow quench at linear, then velocity is a adiabatic parameter, and so on. Acceleration may be a adiabatic parameter. So depending on R, V plays different we has different meanings. So this suggests that perhaps we should play a little bit with the adiabatic perturbation theory, where small parameter will be proximity to instantaneous ground state. That's how we can understand these results. And second, we know that non-analytic scalings are usually related to some singularities and some susceptibilities. So we need to identify what will be the relevant adiabatic susceptibility. So let me elaborate a little bit on how you can get all the scalings more accurately, not just hand-waving argument. So we have a general Schrodinger equation. Let's try to solve it in instantaneous energy basis. So we expand our wave function in this many-body basis, which moves with the Hamiltonian. And then the exact Schrodinger equation has this form, where this is the additional part coming from the fact that a basis changes in time. Now we just use usual perturbation theory, but for this equation. So in the adiabatic limit, we won't have any transitions between states. If there is a Berry phase, you can include it. And then we expand around this no transition kind of ground state. If we do sudden quenches, we will get something which might remind you, should remind you, ordinary perturbation theory. So the only difference is that it's symmetrized version. So it's in a way, it's nicer. Because when you do perturbation theory, you can expand either around initial state or around final state, and you lose some symmetries. If you go back, you will get slightly different expression. Here you automatically get a symmetric representation, and it actually better, it's much less divergent. But anyway, so in perturbative limit, adiabatic perturbation theory indeed reduces to usual perturbation theory. Now, what happens if we, instead of sudden cringe, consider slow cringe? Then this expression gets slightly more involved. So there is a phase which starts playing a role, as we all know. But as long as we have some discontinuity, so if lambda of t is a non-analytic function, immediately this discontinuity is a small parameter, a small perturbative parameter. So, and we can do power law expansion in this parameter v, and in the leading order we will find expression which looks like generalization of this usual perturbation theory. So we have v times this matrix element divided by a somewhat higher power of denominator. But now we can find some measure of non-adiabaticity, and a convenient measure would be, say, adiabatic fidelity. Instantaneous overlap is instantaneous ground state of your state with instantaneous ground state. So for sudden quenches, adiabatic fidelity just becomes usual fidelity. Because if you do a sudden quench, and that's the way, I think, more intuitive way to think about fidelity. You can think about this as overlap of great wave functions, but you can think about this as probability to remain in the ground state if you do a quench. It's obviously the same, but we somehow have, at least myself, have more intuition about the second way of thinking.
Is the adiabatic fidelity a function of time? It looks that way.
Yes, yes. So, but if for sudden quench, it's not a function of time. So now we can define probability of exciting this system. It's 1 minus this fidelity squared. And we have very nice expression. So it's this v squared, a small parameter squared, times some susceptibility. So in this susceptibility, like all susceptibilities, it's square of some matrix element divided by some power of energy denominator. So we can call it generalized adiabatic susceptibility of order 2r plus 2. And when r is equal to 0, it's usual fidelity susceptibility. So I just want to emphasize there are two kind of contributions. Of course, they coexist, but I still want to single them out. So one contribution here comes from high energies, from ultraviolet part. And so this part will be completely perturbative, analytic. So denominator is high, so the series is convergent, and we have this perturbative result for the fidelity. It's perturbative in this parameter v. But the other limit is infrared, low energies. And if the system is gapless, we might have divergences here. So it's universal, it's non-analytic, it's cutoff independent. And the obvious statement, of course, that smoother protocols, they favor more low energy contribution, they cut off high energies. It's sort of what we know. If you do a smooth protocol, you don't make many transitions to high energy states. Now we have this susceptibility. It's, of course, tempting to express it through correlation functions. It's like a fluctuation dissipation relation. And once we have correlation functions, we can now read scaling dimensions. So we know what's the scaling dimension of this operator V. And only at this point it becomes important that it's relevant or marginal. Because scaling dimension of this operator V is related to this exponent nu. So we just read the scaling dimension of this object. And as usual, if it's negative, it means it diverges. So and if it diverges, it means that we have infrared catastrophe, infrared dominance. So it diverges in infrared. And we see that if you have a smoother protocol, we make it more negative, which makes sense. We favor more low energy contributions. If you have smaller nu, which is like approaching first order phase transition, we also make things more divergent. But if you have higher dimensionality, we enhance role of high energy states, and this is just effect of density of states. In high dimensions, we have high density of high energy states. So now let me skip it. If you sort of interpret this probability of excitation per unit volume as density of excitations, and you can give lots of arguments why this is so, and this is indeed true in many models, from this you can derive the scalings, which I just advertised. So this scaling I showed before, and of course if V is very, very small, so V is 10 to the minus 20, then any finite system perturbation theory should be restored. But now non-elliticity suits in this system size dependence. So same for energy. So basically main conclusion is that quantum Kibble-Zurich scaling and its generalizations are associated with singularities in the adiabatic susceptibilities and then this fidelity. So there are actually interesting corollaries from this analysis. I said I need quantum critical point, but in reality I do not need it. It's enough to have gapless phase. And then it's important that we are driving marginal perturbation. So suppose we are changing mass in our bosonic liquid. Then this whole analysis still goes through, but nu is infinity. We don't have correlation then, so we just ignore it. And we see that scaling dimension of this fidelity susceptibility is d minus 2zr. Interesting fact, if you have a sudden quench r equal to 0, it's never negative. So in a way, perturbation theory always works. But if you consider smoother protocols, it can become negative. And if it's negative, you get universal scaling for the density of excitations in the power d over zr. And otherwise, if protocols are not sufficiently smooth, then it's v squared.
These excitations you're talking about are single particles.
Yes, yes.
You're not talking about collective excitations.
No, this can be collective.
This could be collective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, actually, this applies to entropy, but I need to introduce entropy. Because for entropy, I don't need to say these words, single particle meaning.
Because if they're collective, then you have to worry about the different wavelengths.
Sure, but that's length scale is you can interpret as characteristic momentum. So that's length scale. And these are all scaling arguments. This is not just.
Actually, just a comment or a question on the norm calculus. So actually, when it's ultraviolet dominant, it becomes universal, right?
No. No, it becomes cutoff. It's perturbative. This is universal. This is perturbative.
Maybe it's just like V squared is just independent of anything. Here independent.
Yes, but coefficient depends on the cutoff. It's like usual perturbation theory. So you don't know. So if you are say usual critical point, if you do a sudden quench in one regime, you don't care about any details of your critical point, but only about cutoff.
Right.
In the other regime, you only care about what happens near the critical point, but don't care about
the
cutoff. It's two. It's perturbation theory. So, and one can ask actually interesting question. I think it's another playground for future research. What is really important for adiabaticity? Is it what's important is total quench time, or what's important is the protocol? And actually, first people who addressed this question were Martin Eckstein and Markus Kohler. But actually, from this analysis, we can sort of read the answer. So let's rewrite this answer, not as a function of V, but as a function of total time. That's very easy, right? We know that if we have linear quench, V is the same as 1 over time. If it's quadratic, then the acceleration is 1 over time squared, and so on. So we just rewrite it, and we see a very interesting result, in my opinion. This universal, what I call universal low energy part, it becomes independent of the protocol. So just total time power d over z. I'm just rewriting the same answer through the total time instead of parameter v. It doesn't depend on details of the protocol. Of course, there might be a prefactor, but prefactor doesn't depend on t. While if we are in this UV regime, we're actually very, very sensitive to the protocol. It's t minus 2r. So if you make protocol smoother, we strongly suppress non-adiabatic effects. So of course it's really tempting to say that maybe optimal protocol will be d over 2z, but I'm not sure whether this answer is correct. And actually now Shimon and Armin, his student, have very, very unexpected results about optimization, but I'm not going to
what
talk
do you
about
want
them? It. Say fidelity. So just ask which protocol optimizes fidelity. You can optimize energy. Results will slightly differ, but since it's not my result, I won't announce it. But it's very, very unexpected. Anyway, so from here you can see that if this conjecture is right, then in one dimension, optimal protocol will be actually very weird. It's square root, so it doesn't need to be smooth. I fix my initial and final couplings, And I fix total time, but I'm not saying how I go. It's optimal in this sense, yes, it's optimal. Okay, so let me move to like another topic which is closely connected to this one. Yeah.
Because you optimize only among power law quenches, does it mean you don't include the cartoon you showed from on the previous slide?
Well, what is important actually is only power here and power here, at least for this UV regime. For this regime, I just showed that R is not important, so probably only total time is important. But then most likely we'll be optimizing a prefactor. Prefactor will be definitely shape dependent, but not time. But this is still, it's really preliminary analysis. So it's analysis, actually there is nothing wrong with this analysis, but it's indeed takes into account only non-adiabatistic created here and here.
Is it clear that the powers at both the beginning and the end both are equally important?
Yes, they're both. I didn't emphasize it, but actually yes, you need to add this and this. And if there is a slow protocol, interference between them just vanishes.
Well, one of them is near a critical point and the other one isn't.
So well, this is just gapless phase. If one is yes, if you have one critical point, exactly only one is important. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And here's the second part of my talk. It's actually, for here, it's motivated by the first one. I was talking about the density of excitation, which is somewhat weird, undefined object. We need to talk about entropy. But somehow entropy is an avoided topic, like in Harry Potter. So, because we cannot calculate it microscopically, and that's it. But let's see if that really so. So let me take just a look back to this topic, I guess, of yesterday's discussions. I was not here, but I assume that Marcus was probably talking about overlapping things. So if you look into just expectation value of some operator, some observable after a quench, it's trace of density matrix and A, and we all know this very well. And if you look into the time average, we just see that we just remove the phase. So basically, we have a diagonal ensemble. It was said many times already, so I'll skip that. But basically, the conclusion, which largely went from this very nice work by Marcus, that there is no contradiction between this statement and thermalization. So if there is no contradiction, then we shouldn't add any mysterious ingredients to thermalization. We just say that it's dephasing in many body bases. So basically, information about steady state is contained fully in these diagonal elements of rho. And this is true about any thermodynamic observable we can pick up, energy, pressure, magnetization. They're all expectation values of some operators. But it's definitely not true about entropy. It's not linear. So off diagonal elements do not average to zero. So, and also we know that for Neumann entropy is conserved in time, at least in thermally isolated system. But thermodynamic entropy should not be conserved in time. It should increase. So in quantum mechanics, we know that for adiabatic processes, there are no transitions between instantaneous energy levels. So if the two limits are connected, two adiabatic statements, thermodynamic and quantum are connected, then entropy should also know only about diagonal elements. So there is a very simple solution. So we define this object. So it's entropy, which is defined in eigenstates, basis of the Hamiltonian. And actually, I'm not going to prove lots of statements, but let me just state them. So you can prove that diagonal entropy is larger or equal than von Neumann entropy, which is conserved in time. And if you start from stationary state, von Neumann is the same as diagonal. So it increases. It's good. Then you can prove same thing. So if you start from two systems in equilibrium and connect them in any arbitrary way, then some of the diagonal entropies will increase. And this, if you think like more, it's Boltzmann-H theorem. So some of the entropies, I think lots of confusion came in this Boltzmann-H theorem from confusing some of the entropies.
Take them back apart to define.
So you just define your subsystems as isolated particles. So some of this entropies will necessarily increase if you say turn on interactions. Of course, you prove it under restricted settings.
If you define the diagonal entropy of a subsystem by its reduced density matrix?
Yeah.
One question. So the eigenbasis that you're choosing is the basically the eigenbasis of the instantaneous Hamiltonian?
Yes. Yes, yes. Then, at least for me, this was the most convincing statement why the diagonal entropy has something to do with thermodynamics. Let's just start from equilibrium. Now for Gibbs ensemble, I'll generalize it later in a second. And let's consider change of energy for arbitrary process. Now I don't need to assume that system is closed or open. So it's clearly given by this. It's change of energies times original occupation of states plus original energies times change of this occupation of states. Now if you look into change of diagonal entropy, well, norm is conserved, and if you start in equilibrium, this is a simple object, we just recognize one of the terms here, up to T. And we also recognize that this term can be written as a full derivative, because it does not depend on details of the process. Our instantaneous energies are functions of the parameters. So we can just write fundamental thermodynamic relations. So in particular, if lambda stands for volume, we just recover this fundamental thermodynamic relation. So now, what bothered me for some time, this like looks like an ugly definition, basis dependent, and it looks like quantum. Well, there's nothing, no quantum mechanics important so far. But actually, we can rewrite in much nicer form. Let's rewrite it as integral over energy, rho of energy, so that's what usually has Boltzmann distribution, so it's diagonal part of the density matrix, times many body density of states times log of rho of energy. This is a stochastic function, because rho of energy, I'm not assuming that it's smooth. But let's just still make this definition. Then we recognize that this product is nothing but energy distribution. It's exactly energy, a generating function of moments of energy. And log of n is by definition microcanonical entropy. So actually we can rewrite the same definition in this way. So it's integral of dE times work distribution times microcanonical energy minus this integral of dE W of E log of W. You can understand this as operating definition of the entropy. So it's a function of energy distribution, not just average energy. Now I already showed that if you have von Neumann, if you have Gibbs distribution, then this entropy satisfies this fundamental relation. But we know in thermodynamics, it should also satisfy it if you have just big system, no matter what ensemble is. So let's see if this is the case. So if you have a big system, our energy fluctuations are not extensive. And in the last part of the talk, I will elaborate a little bit more. And this, again, has nothing to do with integrability, non-integrability, just with locality of the Hamiltonian. So it actually means that W of E is an error function of the order of square root of E or something like that. So actually, we see that then this term, if you take smooth part of W, it's not really important. It's at most log N. So we are always in thermodynamics ignoring these corrections. So this becomes usual entropy with corrections of the order of one, again, thermodynamic limit. So the only place where we might get problems if this W of E is very, very sparse function. So like if you have exponentially small states occupied. So then stochastic part of W of E can give us something extensive.
So question there. So this is exponentially small in the total number of states, but it can be an exponentially large number, right?
Which one?
The number of states that you are populating.
Sure. But what I'm just saying, if the number of, if W of E is not exponentially sparse, so it's not that exponentially small fraction of the states is occupied, mm-hmm. then contribution from stochastic part will be sub-extensive at least. So let's just see, I'll just give a picture from work of Clemens Nieuwenhuizen and Florian Marquardt. There was similar similar result in paper by Biroli and Andreas and Karina, and also an original paper by Marcos. In it appeared in supplementary material, so that's price you need to pay. Anyway, so I took this one. So this is distribution of probabilities to occupy eigenstates after a quench in some model, actually I don't forget which one, some Hubbard model. So this is close to integrable limit. And then you just see that indeed this is extremely sparse distribution. So basically, you start from some momentum state, you introduce weak interactions, you remain in this momentum state. And this is in non-integrable case. And then you see there are some fluctuations of the order of one. So it's exactly, you see that if you are non-integrable, or at least non-integrable is sufficient but not necessary condition, then this is a relatively dense function, and this entropy is indeed in thermodynamic limit is a unique function of energy. It doesn't matter whether we are in equilibrium or non-equilibrium. It doesn't really matter. And there is actually interesting corollary from this, that we can think about thermalization as delocalization of the initial state in the basis of eigenstates, and I'm sure like David Hughes can say much more about this. So it's, I think, interesting connection between dynamics and thermodynamics, which appears here. Good, so let me show some examples. One is trivial. So let's just consider some gas confined in one half of the container. We remove the wall. We know that phenomenal entropy does not change, but entropy should increase by n log 2, and that's exactly what diagonal entropy is doing. Because if we remove the wall, we double number of states. So it means that probability to occupy single particle states drops by a factor of 2. So each momentum state now becomes superposition of two momentum states. So we immediately get this result. Now let me just play with this kind of more complicated model. I stole this idea from Marco's paper. So we just consider various processes. So one, we just turn on weak link, system prepared in the state, and see what happens. And then diagonal entropy jumps immediately. By the sum of diagonal entropies, it increases. And their sum is somewhat overshoots this diagonal entropy, but it's fine, it's side effect. So if we even consider infinite temperature thermodynamic equilibrium, we will see that log of total number of states is smaller than log of product of two states of subsystems by the same fraction. So if I bother to normalize it, you will see that the sum of diagonal entropy just approaches this guy. I'll probably skip that. So we can see the same thing with the reversibility. So if you periodically drag this weak link, actually not really periodically, stochastically, then we just see that this diagonal entropy increases. And this would will happen if we do time averaging between steps. So they're almost the same. But if at some point we start doing time reversal protocol, then of course everything comes back, and entropy should also come back. But as long as we introduce very weak non-integral perturbation, entropy starts increasing. So it's again, it's a small system, but something we know very well.
Non-integrable perturbation, which you didn't time reverse? Or?
I just time reversed Hamiltonian, really. So if you do exact time reversal, no, in the green curve, you introduce slight mistake.
So it's a mistake in the time reversal.
It's a mistake in time reversal, yeah. So and finally, if you look into entropy versus energy for different protocols, which are very non-equilibrium, you just see that it's, again, it's unique function, at least for a small system, you can't expect better. So these are different, very different time dependencies of energy and entropy, but entropy versus energy remains unique, more or less. So now, one of the uses of this entropy is that it can be actually a measure of non-adiabaticity instead of this density of excitations or whatever. So let's just see, go through summary of the first part of the talk again. So first we discuss this probability of excitations for fidelity. It's very nice, it's universal. It does not depend on the choice of observables, but it's not intensive. The probability of exciting a system is one. If we consider a universe and excite one electron in the moon, we are done. So it's not a good experimental measure. So there is another measure, density of single particle excitations. It's universal, it's intensive, it's well-defined in thermodynamic limit, but it actually depends on knowing structure of excitations, and it's defined in non-integrable systems. This when you never you talk to experimentalists, they always ask a question, what shall I measure? And there is no obvious question to answer to it. Of course, Kibble-Durick talks about topological excitations, but relation of topology to this is very obscure, at least to my opinion. But there is energy or heat. It's even better. It's universal, it's intensive, it's measurable. But the problem is here that it's not easy to separate it from adiabatic energy. So if we are crossing the critical point and we continue our process, we still have a lot of processes going on. So say we excite a gapped particle, but then decay into gapless excitations and so on. So, and this is really non-universal part. So to make energy universal, you need to start at critical point and come back exactly to the critical point. Then you have universal spectrum. But the nicest of all is entropy. It's universal. It's intensive. It's sensitive only to the crossing critical point. And as I argued, it's measurable. It's just related to energy distribution. All right. So now let me, in the remaining 20 minutes, go briefly through the other two topics. And as I said, this is really a work in progress, both of them.
So, a bit more about measuring.
Through energy distribution. Yeah, so you typically...
Energy distribution.
Well, you can try to do time of flight, or you can do it even better. You just drive your system adiabatically to a simple regime of weakly interacting particles. And then you know thermodynamics works. So from this temperature...
You do your quench and then you adiabatically...
And then you adiabatically drive it into a simple regime. That's, I think, one of the ways to measure. Yes, yes. So it's doable. All right, so it's time evolution is an RG process. So let me again give some motivation coming from the same statements which I flashed before. So why this can happen? Why we can think about evolution as RG process at all? So I'm coming back to this averaging procedure. So we are looking into some quench and look into observable at some time t. Then if you do this partial averaging, actually what we are doing effectively, we are eliminating high frequency, high oscillating terms, but keeping low oscillating terms. So actually instead of doing time averaging, we can really say an RG or introduce a cutoff. We just say that those energies which are closer than some cutoff lambda, which we can relate to time as P over T, for them instead of this phase, factor we put 1, and for those which oscillate we'll put 0. There's no time anymore. Time is just cutoff parameter. So and then the whole dynamics is just slowly reducing the cutoff. Of course this is a trivialized RG because it assumes that we know the basis. And we don't know many body bases. It's the hardest problem. But we can use this as an insight. We can say that well, let's just try to eliminate highly oscillating states in the non-interacting Hamiltonian. And because of interactions, see the feedback. So what is feedback to interactions? So in this specific example, we consider the Zeldzieck mesh. It's sudden separation of two-dimensional superfluids. So initially, they're strongly coupled. So it means that the relative phase is well-defined. And then we suddenly separate them. And they start to fluctuate. And then you can show that at short times there will be a light cone dynamics. So with, there is a light cone which moves with sound velocity, and within this light cone we are getting some algebraic state with some effective temperature which depends on this ratio U over J. So, but we know that this state cannot be true equilibrium state because this temperature can be arbitrarily high, but in reality if it's very high, we will have vortex anti-vortex pairs, which will unbind, and we will get a normal state. But this process is much slower. So we can see numerically what happens. That indeed, we start from a solid state, then we move, evolve for some time, and then we go to a well-defined algebraic state, and these vortex anti-vortex pairs just start to emerge. Then wait longer, longer, and longer, and slowly they unbind. So there is a clearly a time scale separation in this problem. So we want to use this for our advantage. So and this is like an outline of what we are doing. So this is classical transition, so it's completely classical treatment. So we actually need to solve these nonlinear dynamical equations of motion. So they have second derivative in time, and there is no Langevin noise or something. It's a closed system. But we have a nonlinear term. So how do we solve it? The ideas are very similar to usual RG. Actually, they are identical to usual RG with some new ingredient. So we split our field into low momentum piece and high momentum piece. And then we are saying that for high momentum piece, we are using perturbation theory. For high momentum piece, which correspond to short wavelengths, these vortices are not that important. They're perturbative. So for them, we can use this G as perturbation. So and then for low momentum piece, we are getting these modified equations, and you immediately see where first piece of RG comes in. Because if we average the theta squared, it will renormalize G. So this is a trivial renormalization which immediately comes in. Well, this in the leading order of perturbations will average to zero, because this high momentum piece oscillates a lot. But if you go to first order perturbation theory for high momentum piece, it will acquire a slow component. So that's how this G squared contribution which appears. So, and this G squared contribution will exactly renormalize this lambda and mu. If you just do things properly, it's very easy to show. So the additional ingredient which enters here is that energy also renormalizes. Because of course total energy is conserved, but energy, particularly low energy modes, does change. But for this we can use adiabatic elimination, so this is like a smooth function of time, and then we know that adiabatic invariants are conserved, and that we use as an additional ingredient. So once we put everything into place, we're actually getting three equations, not two. There is one equation for mu, but one of them is not important. One of them is not critical. So there are two important equations, and you might recognize these are just usual Coster-Stowers equations. But now L, this RG parameter, is real time. It's not imaginary time. It's not temperature. It's real time. So we indeed recover that in the long time limit, we can have two scenarios, as we expect, is a relevant normal phase, relevant vortices normal phase.
Real time, or it's the time of a block. Because when you limit, but you do momentum space RG. So
it's momentum space RG, but this is real time. So what I'm doing, I am averaging, I'm extending time, that averaging of frequencies of the order of cutoff. Mm-hmm. Then I again extend time and so on.
So this is real time, but this is real time. Units of larger and larger.
Yeah. So by the way, relativistic invariance is also part of RG. So first we worried that first derivative terms will appear. No, they do not. So you preserve this relativistic invariance of equations. I don't know whether it's obvious fact or not, but you preserve this shape, you preserve this shape. You don't generate odd derivatives in time. So it's something we worried a lot, because first derivative, of course, will be more relevant, but it doesn't show up. So basically, we recovered these two scenarios, relevant or irrelevant. So in irrelevant regime, the only thing vortices are doing just renormalize our temperature, again, as we expect. We can get some few universal conclusions that, first of all, thermodynamics here merges as a result of RG process. We did not show that Gibbs distribution is an attractor. Just for this particular problem, its system always stays there. I have lots of arguments to argue why this should be attractor, but it's still something which we need to add to this RG, basically equations for energy distribution, not just average energy.
You showed in your simulations before the system first goes to a state, pre-thermalized
yes.
state
right.
with power
yes.
correlation,
yes.
and only later flows
yes.
to this
yes.
Thermal state.
Yes.
And can you see this in the RG flow, that the flow goes to some kind
of... Well, for us it was a sort of starting point.
Oh, okay.
So this pre-thermalized state was a starting point. I think you can, but it should be more complicated. So in RG, we basically assume that we already have a well-defined energy of this high momentum state. So it actually means, if you want, that we already assume that different energy states are uncorrelated. And this is a very simple averaging. The different non-interacting states are not correlated. So this is a result of pre-thermalization. Now, like Stefan introduced this term, or maybe someone else. So we see, as I said, it's really a work in progress. Now it seems that epsilon expansion also comes from this, but I don't want to, still things need to be done. So basically we see that for this problem, equilibrium thermodynamics emerges as a result of RG process. And RG is, of course, a semigroup transformation. So lost information is because we are averaging off fast energy modes. We are losing this information. And one prediction which you have, which might be again obvious, but at least I didn't know about its existence before, that near this critical quench, which drives you to KT transition, you'll have exponential relaxation time. This now result of RG process. Well, the final part should be more like entertaining, but I think it's also interesting. It's what I advertise it. So it's what happens is basically from sudden quench to repeated quench. Suppose we are not just doing one process, but we keep going. So like with cold atoms, we change our curvature in time periodically. So yeah, and we know that we will hit the system. And the question we want to ask, whether you'll hit the system in the same way like in conventional heating. So if you do this usual grill, we know that our chicken or, carrots for vegetarians should be satisfy Gibbs distribution. It should satisfy fluctuation dissipation relation. And in particular, this width of energy distribution should be universal, T squared times specific heat. But now what if we do the same process in a microwave?
You overcooked by then? You take it out before it gets to equilibrium.
Yes, this might be. It's actually one of the problems of the treatment which I'm going to present. Because you need to reach this steady state and you might stop your experiments before. But anyway, so let me still present the results. So you can imagine that you actually, if you want to get asymptotic results where it's in equilibrium, you just hit it somewhat slower. So if you hit it somewhat slower, you can still get it.
You reduce the heat to 18, which is the selling heat, and then it's...
Well, this chicken is just a bunch of cold atoms or some isolated system. But anyway, so we're hitting them. So, and you can ask the same set of questions. Do we get Gibbs distribution after this? Is there any attractor at all? Can we use flotation dissipation relations like universal width? There are lots of questions to ask, and I can answer only one of them. So I'm going to use a simple approach. It's a Fokker-Planck equation. So basically, it's valid as long as work per unit time is very small. So we just add. So it doesn't apply. The results don't apply to sequences. We really hit with a hammer. But we're doing step by step. So we can write some Fokker-Planck equation. And there are two parameters which enter. One is average work or energy increase per unit time. And the other is width increase per unit time. And in principle, we can think that maybe these are independent parameters. But they're not. It turns out that unitarity of the evolution, or as I realized from talking to Yuri, if it's the same as Yerzinski equalities and fluctuation theorem, they require that the attractor for this dynamics, for this any dynamics in isolated system is always equal to constant. If you think might think about increased temperature as you're approaching to flatter and flatter distribution. And this will be any attractor for any Hamiltonian dynamics as long as you average over phases. So as long as you say, do a process, wait until some time, random time, average over time, then do process again. So this actually means that this attractor must be also the case for Fokker-Planck equation. And this actually gives a relation between coefficients I and b. They are not arbitrary, they are very specific. And as I said, this is, you can derive from that this statement is equivalent to Yerzinski equalities. So and from this, I'm not going to elaborate. Work mostly was done by Luca and Guy, so the students. So if someone's interested in the talk, you should really ask them. But basically, this is the result of this Fokker-Planck equation, that asymptotically width goes to this simple formula. It's A squared, so A is, remember, energy added per system into system per unit time. And we assume this is a function of energy only. So we, in the same, have the same protocol. We are not changing protocol, which is step. Times a simple integral. This T is equilibrium temperature. It's microcanonical temperature. It's related to density of states. It has nothing to do with system being in equilibrium or whatever, divided by a square root of E. Now, to analyze, this is the final result, but let's try to analyze it. So let's assume that temperature is some power of energy, which is always the case in at least in low temperatures. And for simplicity, let's make an assumption that we add energy per unit time as some power of energy. Then, out of from this formula, there are very simple results which come in.
Can you say again what sigma is?
So sigma is the width of the distribution.
Width
of delta E squared. Fluctuations of energy. Which is a function of E.
And E
is average energy.
E is the mean.
Yes. So this is, of course, result valid for large systems. So we have many degrees of freedom. It can be many, many non-interacting particles, by the way. So we're not limiting. Interactions are not important. We can have many non-interacting. And the result is like that. So if you are heating sufficiently slower, if this power, so how much energy you have per unit time, is less than 1 this plus alpha over 2, then actually you are getting non-equilibrium widths multiplied by some universal factor. So equilibrium width times universal, equilibrium I mean canonical width, so it's canonical distribution, times universal factor. And if you want to make this factor small, you actually want to make this eta large and negative. So it actually means the only way to get narrow distribution is to, as energy increase, add less and less energy. But it's interesting that this result does not really depend on how much energy you put per unit time, or it doesn't know about any details, basically. This is asymptotic result, so the only thing we need to satisfy is that energy added per unit time is smaller than energy itself, in some sense. While if we, this exponent is bigger than this 1 plus alpha over 2, we are going to runaway regime. And this formulas, if I wouldn't tell their meaning, should resemble your phase transition. Because we have here simple answer by universal prefactor. In the other regime, we have non-universal prefactor, but universal exponent. So which will be equilibrium width times universal power of energy. So it's interesting, what's the transition corresponds to? So what's this magic eta is equal to 1 plus alpha over 2? It actually corresponds to regime when entropy grows as time squared. So it actually means that if you want to be with canonical widths, you need to make sure that entropy grows slower than square of time. And into this result, nothing really enters. Okay, so this is summary and outlook. So I talked to you about universal non-adiabatic response of various quantities near quantum critical point. I argued that they can be understood through infrared divergences of fidelity susceptibility and its generalization. Then the questions which are remaining, still dependence of dissipation or energy absorption on quench time and shape. I gave you some arguments, but in general, it's a really open question. I think interesting, very interesting question. So what's the role of non-integrability and relaxation? That's also not very well known yet. You can imagine lots of interplays with UV singularities. I think interesting application can be this non-adiabatic Casimir force, which might be very UV dependent in high dimensions. Then I didn't talk about heat, but if we can define entropy, we can define heat as well. They can be defined microscopically, and laws of thermodynamics really follow from just microscopic dynamics. So you need one ingredient, is many body delocalization. So you need to delocalize between states. So thermalization or time evolution, we can view it, at least in a particular setup, as RG process. Of course, the question of generality of the statements, integrability, this is still open question. And the last part, I argued that we still have universality, even if we drive the systems very far from equilibrium. And of course, the key thing is experiments. Thank you for that.
So I might be missing something, but in the RG part of your talk, so I'm not clear on what exactly the fixed points would mean. So if I started off the system, you know, if I quenched the system, I know what the energy is right after the quench.
Yes.
The energy stays the same, you know, to infinity.
Yes.
I can just figure out what the temperature is corresponding to that energy.
Yes, but if your fixed point is Gibbs distribution, you're absolutely right. But what if it's not?
Okay, so...
Well, what if your system is integrable, for example? Actually, there are examples... I guess, coming from weakly non-integrable systems like one-dimensional turbulence, where you have in slightly different setups attractors which are some power laws, like Kolmogorov power law. This can be another fixed point. We have results which I didn't show, that if you do Fermi-Pass-Toulam problem and then some fluctuations, you will also get non-thermal attractor which lives for basically infinitely long time. So at least as long as we can simulate them. So it's really unclear. So there might be some non-equilibrium fixed point, but this fixed point is actually really fixed point. Kolmogorov power law is very well defined. It's not Gibbs, but it's well defined. But since it's open question, it's open question. So you can speculate.
It's not like a comment. I was just thinking exactly in the direction of this integrability that I have. Because somehow, quite strongly, you are based on the fact that at the end you analyze this diagonal elements of the matrix in the energy. So there are pathological systems, like, I don't know, take bosons in the harmonic potentials, you start putting them, then the degeneracy, so to say,
goes extravagantly strong.
Of course, you have really dependence not only on the diagonal, but on the coherence.
Yes, I agree. Yes, it's extremely interesting. So, for one thing, for sure, we can say that usual thermodynamics will not apply because the systems will not relax. So, in this sense, you can think what's the reasonable extension of this entropy would be. So how you need to think about questions of adiabatic connectivity in some sense. Because I used, in a way, I didn't talk about that, but you can really show that quantum, at least again in simple setups, quantum adiabatic theorem is related to thermodynamics through phase space. If we move slower and slower, phase space for transitions gets smaller and smaller, and we eventually recover the limit. So basically, I should say that this limit where diagonal elements are constant, it's adiabatically connected to whatever state you can prepare. But if you have lots of off-diagonal elements, it's not clear what will be diagonal adiabatic connectivity. So probably need to refine what's the entropy based on this notion. So it's very interesting, I agree.
I have a question about connection about the first part of the talk and Coster-Lets, Tauler's part of the talk. So I understand that in the first part of the talk you assume that the correlation length, everything depends as a power law on the distance of the phase transition point. Now imagine that this dependence is exponential. So what would, like, in a near the Coster-Lets Tauler's transition? So I wonder what would change?
Well, you will see very, very weak singularity, and there were even works. So I forgot honestly the authors, but they analyzed, say, fidelity susceptibility for Coster-Lets Tauler's phase transition, they saw nothing. So basically what happens is that there's a huge analytic part, this UV part, which you need to subtract. But on top of this part, there is weak exponential discontinuity. So I have no clue how you're going to see it. So in a way, Coster-Lets Tauler's phase transition, it's very hard to see in these quenches. So, but for sudden quench, that's actually much of large amplitude, it's much better. So now small parameter is distance to the new non-equilibrium, if you want, critical point. It's not quench amplitude, but lambda minus critical quench amplitude, if you want. And there, you have exponentially long time. So I think this should be, of course, in finite size systems, there will be cutoffs and so on. But I think this is much more straightforward to monitor. So pre-built, so if you're in equilibrium, I think it's nearly impossible to see KT transition, at least in this sort of setups.
I have a live question. So about your IG part of the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So you derive this equation for the KT transition.
Yes.
So is this independent of initial condition?
That's what not shown yet. So that's what I'm saying. We did not show yet that fixed temperature is attractor for dynamics. I can give you like lots of arguments why this should be so. Suppose that we start from some smooth temperature distribution. Then actually, even if without any RG scheme, when you do the coarse graining, you sort of reduce your energy window. So you make distribution flatter and flatter. So now you can imagine that it's unlikely that interactions move you the other way around. But basically, still you can imagine, what if I populate only high energy states and nothing at low energy? I don't know, honestly. So what we show that if you start from non-equilibrium temperature, then it always remains in this fixed temperature state, I mean phonons remain always in fixed temperature state, but temperature somehow renormalizes. So instead of renormalizing distribution, we just normalize temperature. But this is something I'm working on now. Hopefully I'll have resolved something.
Yeah, I have a question about the first part. So when you consider a sudden quench, we know that you can essentially extract universal properties by mapping, you know, by making a peak rotation and mapping the system into problem boundary statistical mechanics. So I'm wondering, do you know what is the analog of this when you have your generic, I mean, you said that all these quenches fall into the same kind of class. So it should be possible to have a similar.
Well, perhaps if you consider, I don't know, some linear potential in space, then, but sudden quench in time, maybe it will be the same. But I don't know really.
Yeah.
I don't know. But you can probably play with this relativistic invariance. But what you are saying is only true for relativistic invariant systems. It's not true in for conformal invariant.
True.
You need to be able to change space and time, right?
No, not really.
No? Okay,
no,
maybe.
I mean, you can do the mapping always.
I see.
Use transfer matrices.
I see. Well, I don't know. You might tell me more about it.
Okay.